Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Stauber, co-author of the book Banana Republicans, who takes a critical look at how the Republican Party has come to control all branches of the U.S. government and influence American politics. Lebanese activist and organizer Raida Hatoum, who considers the plight of Palestinians living in squalid refugee camps in Lebanon. And Connecticut State Representative Mike Lawler, co-chair of the Consensus Project, who discusses efforts underway across the U.S. to provide better care for mentally ill offenders. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Nation magazine reports that political violence still grips Cambodia 25 years after the murderous Khmer Rouge were forced out of power by the Vietnamese army. Instead of celebrations, the capital city of Phnom Penh is dominated by the fear of political assassinations. Union leader Chia Vichia, who founded a major opposition party, was shot and killed in front of a newsstand. Over 10,000 people came to his funeral. 24-year-old popular singer Touch Sray Nitch was another victim of the violence that has plagued Cambodia since last year's election when the ruling Cambodia People's Party, led by Prime Minister Hun Sen, failed to win the two-thirds majority it needed to govern without coalition partners. In early July, Hun Sen signed a power-sharing agreement with opposition leader Prince Ranariddh of the royalist Phun Sin Pek Party. The ongoing violence has delayed any effort to bring the Khmer Rouge to justice. In 2003, Cambodia and the United Nations signed an agreement calling for a Cambodia-led tribunal to investigate the genocide committed by the communist government that left over 1.7 million people dead. There are suspicions among some Cambodians that Hun Sen, who years ago left the ranks of the Khmer Rouge, may be trying to cover up the large number of former Khmer Rouge members in his ruling party, who are fearful of a tribunal. After being the poster child of the anti-sweatshop movement for nearly a decade, The Gap is cleaning up its act. The news magazine In These Times reports that the clothing retailer, which also owns Old Navy and Banana Republic stores, has released a 40-page social responsibility report documenting the low wages and poor working conditions in over 3,000 factories in 50 nations across the globe. The report, compiled with the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility and the Calvert Investment Group, found that few of its clothing contractors met the Gap's corporate code of conduct. Many Gap critics, such as Unite, the textile workers' union, have praised the clothing chain for the level of honesty in the report. It found that between 25% and 50% of the factory workers in Central America and the Caribbean were paid less than the minimum wage. Clothing workers in Africa and Asia were often required to work over 60 hours a week. Despite the progress made by activists over the last decade, Charlie Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee, who first targeted the Gap in 1995, says the lack of labor rights is at the heart of the sweatshop crisis. Some factories will be cleaned up, he observed, but when it comes to wages, to having a democratic voice on the shop floor, codes of conduct are a dead end. Unionization, he says, is the only effective remedy. In a burst of Reagan-era nostalgia, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has reclassified frozen French fries as a fresh vegetable. The Bush USDA quietly made the change in 2003 at the urging of the French fry industry after years of pressure to alter the law known as the Perishable Agriculture Commodity Act. In 2000, the Frozen Potato Products Institute made the suggestion that the definition of fresh produce change to include batter-coated French fries, insisting that fried and frozen potatoes are no different than wax on a cucumber. And now U.S. District Judge Richard Schell of Texas has upheld the policy, saying the term fresh vegetable is ambiguous. Tim Elliott, a Chicago attorney who challenged the new batter control rule, called the ruling outrageous. As he told the L.A. Times, "This is only something that lawyers can do," pointing to 100 pages of court documents in the case. Meyer Stamfer of the Harvard School of Public Health says the new rule boggles the mind since frozen French fries are prepared in heart-clogging trans fat oils. In its defense, a lawyer for the USDA insisted the French fries were not processed to the degree that it was no longer fresh since it was still perishable. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. Thank you.
After the last two federal election cycles, the Republican Party finds itself firmly in control of the U.S. government. George W. Bush sits in the White House thanks to his selection by a GOP-dominated Supreme Court amid controversy in the razor-thin Florida vote, while having decisively lost the national popular ballot. The Republicans, who also hold power in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, now control all three branches of government for the first time since 1932. In so doing, the GOP has fulfilled the dream of the late President Ronald Reagan and other conservative activists. The party has succeeded by working aggressively to outmaneuver and outspend their Democratic rivals in influencing regulation of the electoral system, dominating the agenda of the lobbyist establishment and the nation's media. The authors of a new book warn that the success of the Republican Party in consolidating power across political and corporate spheres puts America's democratic pluralism at risk. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Stauber, who, along with Sheldon Rampton, are co-authors of the book Banana Republicans, How the Right Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State. Here, Stauber takes a critical look at how the GOP has been able to dominate U.S. politics and maintain its hold on power.
Well, this book, I think, really began a few years ago when Sheldon and I were researching the Republican Party, and especially after the terror attacks of 9/11, 2001, seeing how the right-wing movement in the United States and the Republican Party were able to exploit the terror attacks of 9/11 for political gain. And probably the most striking example of that was how in the fall of 2002, when the Bush administration began its sell job on the war in Iraq, which the White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, compared to a product launch, we really were astonished to see how the Republican Party managed to win the fall 2002 elections and gain control of both houses of Congress by making the issue the war in Iraq. Now here we are in 2004. The war was launched a year ago, and we find the United States just in a horrible situation, bogged down in a guerrilla war with no end in sight, people like Wesley Clark speculating that there's a 2-to-1 chance that the U.S. is going to be driven out of Iraq and that this situation is going to end in catastrophe. And one of the major ironies is that during this election year, the Democratic candidate for the presidency, John Kerry, managed to vote for this war. And Democratic political operatives like James Carville and Democratic leaders from Daschle to Gephardt to Hillary Clinton endorsed this war. And by endorsing the war, the Democrats played right into the hands of the Republicans, making the 2002 electoral debate one of whether the war was a good idea. They conceded that. The Republicans control both houses. And now, on what appears to be the most important issue leading into the November election, the Democrats have no traction because, again, they supported the war. So every time you turn around these days, it appears that the Republicans are in ascendancy. They have brilliant political strategists. They play politics not just to win. They treat politics, as we explain in Banana Republicans, like a war, and the object in war is to annihilate the enemy. And bipartisanship under the rules of engagement that the Republicans pursue is, as Newt Gingrich is said to have proclaimed, a date rape. Bipartisanship is date rape.
Very often it seems that there's a direct pipeline from folks at the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing think tanks directly into the mouths of people like Sean Hannity, a right-wing talk show host, or Rush Limbaugh, and dozens of others, you know, on Fox TV and other stations and outlets around the country. You want to just examine that kind of symbiosis between the two?
Well, absolutely. It's a symbiosis, and there are direct links, and one feeds on the other. And we're really talking about a right-wing propaganda machine The think tank was pioneered by the Republican right, and the most powerful think tanks like Heritage, Hudson, Cato, American Enterprise Institute, Competitive Enterprise Institute, that we examine in the book, are funded, again, by far-right ideologues, people who are the money behind foundations like Skaife and Bradley and Coors, and they have anti-gay, anti-black, anti-environmental, anti-feminist agendas, and they've had them for a very long time. And what they've done through their think tanks is they've figured out ways to take ideas along those lines that used to be very marginal and unpalatable and package them and promote them. So concepts, for instance, like affirmative action, which used to be a really noble endeavor, at least perceived that way, become seen as some sort of racist enterprise aimed against white people. You know, how did that total flip-flop come about? Well, it came about through the right-wing think tanks and through developing right-wing scholars and pumping out position papers and getting it into the media. And the rise of the right-wing media has probably been, in my opinion, the single development over the last decade most responsible for this stranglehold that the far-right Republican Party has over now every branch of government.
I'd like to just end up with your conclusion. In the book, it's titled The Three Banana Problem. How to combat the right's ruthless and often unethical tactics employed to prevail in these elections and overcoming the large money advantage that these politicos have in terms of their kind of iron triangle between industry and the lobbyists and government and the political party there. How do you do it?
We look throughout the book and analyze the one-party state and see if there are things that are being done from which lessons can be drawn for progressives. But the thing to remember is that the Republicans view this as war. In order to really confront that sort of ideology, we have to get very serious, we who are on the progressive liberal left side, in organizing our constituency. And that hasn't been the case with the Democratic Party. So I think we'll only have our country back when we really have a movement for democracy that takes power back from the elite and returns it to people in communities.
That was John Stauber, who, along with Sheldon Rampton, are co-authors of the book Banana Republicans, How the Right Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State, published by Tarcher Penguin. Visit the author's website at www.bananarepublicans.org. The United Nations estimates that there are over 400,000 Palestinian refugees living in impoverished camps scattered throughout Lebanon. Refugees here represent the living face of the displacement crisis for Palestinians worldwide, while also providing context for the Palestinian struggle for the right of return. The issue of the right of return has been the focus of international headlines recently, with the disengagement plan put forward by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, endorsed by U.S. President George W. Bush, and vocally supported by Democratic presidential hopeful John Kerry. The disengagement plan foresees the eventual evacuation of major Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip, but rejects the internationally recognized right of return for millions of Palestinian refugees displaced during the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. For Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, whose political and social identity is defined by a belief in the right of return, the disengagement plan put forward by Sharon is a devastating blow. Palestinian refugees living in Lebanon today say they are subjected to systematic repression by the Lebanese government. They are forbidden from owning property, traveling freely, working in over 70 professions, and unable to obtain proper health care. During a recent trip to Beirut, Between the Lines' Stefan Christoph spoke with Raida Hatoum, a Lebanese activist who works with Najda, a women's NGO network operating in Palestinian refugee camps throughout Lebanon.
The situation of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon is not like any other situation for the refugees in Syria or Jordan or in other places. Even UNRWA says that the situation of refugee camps in Lebanon is worse than those in Gaza under occupation. It would take you to come and visit the camps to see what this means. the discrimination is really clear in the laws imposed on the Palestinian refugees by the Lebanese government. The refugees are not allowed to work in any kind of profession that they can make a union out of, which means the Lebanese regime does not really want the Palestinians to be organized. And other law is like the free of movement. The Palestinians in Lebanon, they don't have a free, they're free of movement, which we can see in a very ironic picture. We can see it in the camps of the south, where four camps on the south are besieged by a Lebanese army. If you will go there, you will be shocked. You will think this is an Israeli army besieging a camp in the West Bank. So here we see that the Lebanese regime does not want the Palestinians to be organized. They don't want them to feel in ease, you know, living here in Lebanon. Since they are not allowed to work and not allowed to move freely, this is what we call imposing poverty on them. This is only aims at destroying the infrastructure of the Palestinian community.
Right now, the economic and the political situation for the Palestinian refugees is very bad, as you explained. Can you maybe speak about that in relationship to the history of Palestinian refugees in this country? Maybe give people an idea as to the history of the camps. Let's go back and look at the origins of the camps.
As we all know, that Israel was established after a war that aimed at replacing the local people with others. So the refugees were forced to flee their houses and villages, and they were told by the hosting countries that they will go back in a few days or a few weeks. Then the UNRWA was established because the United Nations took responsibility of this refugee question, because the international community thought that they do hold a responsibility, because it was the United Nations who signed and approved the establishment of Israel. So the United Nations decided they will take care of the refugees until they go back home. The camps were established in Lebanon. There was 15 official camps. During the civil war, three of those camps were destroyed completely. Its people got massacred, and those who survived, they became displaced and refugees inside other refugee camps. Palestinian refugees are forgotten, you know, not just by accident, no, by purpose, because as we said earlier, no one wants really to give a real solution, but I believe that people can bring the real solution, ordinary people. We don't have to wait until the right of return so the Palestinians can live with dignity. I believe that we should work hard to tell the others about the situation Palestinians in Lebanon are enduring. A homeland is not a five-star hotel. People became refugees because there was conflict, there was an occupation. So until we put an end to such an occupation or to find a solution, we do it together with the Palestinians. It's not like we're doing alone. With the Palestinians, we can organize a lot of campaigns demanding civil rights, right to work at least. And until the right of return is achieved, people have the right to enjoy their right. Anyone can be in the position of the Palestinian refugees. It has been happening for a long time. And what was the result? The result that in Canada and USA we have what is so-called reservation. People inside those reservations live in complete misery, you know, not because they don't deserve to live a good life or they don't deserve to have access to better services, but just because the system does not need them. The system needed their natural resources, their land, and maybe in the prisons you can see them. They just imprison them and they make them work as slaves. All those people who have the solidarity for the refugees, whether in Lebanon or Canada or any other place, they would do a lot of support if they would really get involved in the local struggle, fighting against economic and social oppression, fighting for justice, how they see it, fighting privatization, fighting racism. This all will help because it's the same issue, pushing the struggle towards more good results for the Palestinian refugees. It will make the refugees more powerful to achieve more results out of the struggle.
That was Raida Hatoum, a Lebanese activist working with Najda, a women's NGO network operating in Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. For more information, visit the Beirut Indie Media website at www.beirut.indymedia.org. Connecticut was rocked by the suicides of five inmates in a 10-week period from April to June 2004, numbers usually seen in the course of a year. In a system with 18,500 inmates in jails and prisons, the State Department of Corrections has acknowledged that up to 2,500 of those incarcerated are afflicted with clinical mental illness. Each year, 10 million people enter U.S. correction facilities, and studies indicate that the incidence of serious mental illness among these individuals is at least 3 to 4 times higher than occurs in the general population. A politically inspired crackdown on quality of life offenses, such as the possession of narcotics, have put many people with mental illness behind bars, hitting hard those duly diagnosed with mental health and substance abuse disorders. Ill-equipped to provide a comprehensive array of services that these individuals need, corrections administrators often see the health of people with mental illness deteriorate further, prompting behavior issues and disciplinary infractions that only prolong their confinement in the criminal justice system. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Connecticut State Representative Mike Lawler, who co-chairs the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee. Lawler, who also co-chairs the Consensus Project, a national organization that brings together experts in the criminal justice and mental health fields, discusses efforts underway to provide better care for mentally ill offenders.
The problem when it comes to suicide typically is people who have just been admitted to prison or jail. They've just been recently arrested. They're overwhelmed by a variety of things, and they're suicidal. And unfortunately, that's the moment of your incarceration where the least is known about you. And it's also unfortunate that I think maybe 5 or 10 years ago, police and prosecutors and public health people had a lot of options available to them that just aren't available now. For example, emergency rooms had psychiatric beds, which they typically don't have anymore. That's a phenomenon associated with managed care and the cutbacks in funding on certain kinds of things. Not many people have insurance for elaborate mental health services, so hospitals can't make money on it, so they close down their psychiatric beds, and as a consequence, emergency rooms are looking to get rid of the acutely mentally ill people, and sometimes the police take them by default, and the police have nothing else to do besides just bring them to the local jail, and so that's where the suicides typically happen. So it's a combination of things. Number one, what services are available actually in the prisons and jails, but also who is actually being sent to prison and jail. I think people would argue that many of these people who have actually committed suicide probably should not have been there in the first place. They should have been in a psychiatric bed somewhere where you'd get a whole different approach to suicide prevention.
Tell me about the organization that you're part of and how you got to be a co-chair. Are you one of the people who helped found it?
You know, it's interesting if you're involved in discussions about criminal justice, you know, different issues pop up from time to time. So juvenile justice or racial profiling or the death penalty. And 5 or 6 years ago, people on the front lines, police, corrections officers, prosecutors, others, started talking about how it seemed to them that there was a lot of people with mental illness showing up in the system. And they didn't really know why, but they did know that they weren't equipped or trained to handle this kind of a person. I mean, it's one thing if you commit a crime, but if what you really are is mentally ill and you're urinating in public or you're smoking crack or you're trespassing or something like that, you know, those are all crimes, but the real issue is your mental illness, not your criminal behavior. So the criminal justice people were sort of desperate for solutions. And we found at the same time you talked to the mental health professionals, they were complaining that a lot of their resources were being taken away. And as a consequence, they weren't able to deal with typically the homeless, drug and alcohol dependent people that make up a lot of the prison system these days, people with some type of mental illness. And so the Council of State Governments, which is sort of a nationwide, nonpartisan or bipartisan, really, organization, decided that this might be a safe criminal justice topic to talk about. There wasn't really a partisan argument going on here. It wasn't a philosophical thing. Everybody, the cops and the mental health advocates alike, were saying that somebody needs to do something here. This is getting out of control. And so the goal was to see if we can bring everyone together and forge some type of consensus about some things that could be done that would not be controversial, but would actually help solve the problem. And the report that's online now, the consensusproject.org, gives you a clear idea of all the different stakeholders and the suggestions that have been made, which would improve the process. So what we're in the process now of doing is sort of marketing these ideas throughout the country and assuring people that you can do these things without being criticized by your partisan opponents.
Can you just give us some examples of these proposals? What are they, and what's a dollar figure you might that might be attached to them?
If you do it right, you actually end up saving a lot of money, because it's a lot more expensive to deal with a person with mental illness in a prison than it would have been to deal with them in a mental health program, because not only do you have to have all the mental health stuff, but you have to do it inside a prison. So you got the corrections officers and the mental health professionals and all of the elaborate security that goes along with running a prison. You can basically come up with a system which assures everybody that we're only trying to separate persons with mental illness based on how dangerous they might be. So if you have a mental illness issue, but no history of violence, for example, then you probably can get a much better deal, assuming the other resources are there. So in other words, get criminal defendants diverted out of the system. But reassuring everybody that it's actually going to work that way is a complicated process. And so that's part of the consensus project, educating prosecutors, educating defense lawyers, educating judges about how to better do risk assessments on offenders who have a mental illness but aren't actually dangerous. Advocates for the persons with mental illness, for the consumers, they have a lot of concerns about how they're going to be handled in the criminal justice system. Legitimately, they point to the fact that most police and prosecutors really have no idea about mental illness. So they have said that police and prosecutors need to be trained, so when they go in and say, you know, this person really needs another option, that the prosecutors will actually take them seriously. So they've suggested training things. Now, the prosecutors, I used to be a prosecutor, I think normally be resistant to this because they think of themselves as lawyers. But now that they're seeing so many people with mental illness and they themselves are nervous about making the wrong decision regarding a mentally ill person, they want the training. So there's a consensus thing that's been forged.
That was Connecticut State Representative Mike Lawler of the Consensus Project. For more information, call the project at area code 212-482-2320 or visit the group's website at consensusproject.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Stefan Christoph, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Elena Osowski, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.